So yeah, part of the reason we wanted to focus on legacies, we were aware that within Triratna there'd been very little done, and yet, in as we've seen in a minute, in a lot of charities, it's a big area of fundraising. And the one thing that was done was a few years ago, this brochure was produced, probably a good 10 years ago now or something like that, and it was produced by a chap called Surina. And actually, it's very good. It's well worded. A lot of the focus on this is to do with the kind of getting people to make a will and the technical stuff of making a will. Apparently in the fundraising world, that's how legacy fundraising used to be. And these days the trend has shifted, and it's now much more about the case for support. It's about sharing your vision for your charity and so on. And the technical stuff is kind of there, but less to the forefront, as it were. So in a way, it's a little bit kind of dated in terms of the kind of style of legacy fundraising these days. But in other ways, I think it's a very good brochure. Some of the wording in it is very good, I think. But the trouble with this, it was, and I remember, because I was chair of the Birmingham Centre at the time, is we were just centre box, and I didn't know what to do with them. So I kind of sent them out to the Mitras and said, maybe you'd like to think about this, but I didn't really have a clue how to go about it. So in a way, I think it might have been a wasted opportunity. Maybe at some centres they were a bit more clued up about what to do with it, but I felt at a lot of places there probably wasn't the kind of awareness or knowledge about what to do with them. So yeah, we were just aware of that in the development team and wanted to kind of just give people much more of an idea of how to run legacies fundraising. Yeah. So that's the idea of today. And then in the autumn, I'm going to be touring, and Lokabandhu as well, hopefully, touring a lot of UK centres. Again, just sharing this stuff. We're going to do an evening on the chairs meeting in the summer as well, just sharing all these ideas. And we're also going to produce a brochure and a DVD, which I'll say more about later. So there is going to be some new materials available on a website and stuff like that. I'll say more about that later. Just before I kind of get into the stuff, I just wanted to say that the legacy campaign, so all those materials and the DVD and all that, has been funded by money from the Chairs Assembly. So that's money donated by Buddhist centres each year has gone to fund this. But also three centres particularly gave donations, so I just wanted to thank them. One was the Birmingham Buddhist Centre, the other was Brighton Buddhist Centre, and the third one was Glasgow Buddhist Centre. We knew they'd all received legacies, so we said, would you give us a donation to help us run a legacy campaign to help other centres get legacies? And they all gave us a donation, so just wanted to kind of acknowledge that. Yeah. Okay, so the way the day will work is I'm going to present some stuff, first of all, so just various information and ideas, and then we'll stop and do a bit of an exercise. That'll probably take us to lunchtime. Then I'll present some more stuff, then there's another exercise, and then we'll just have a bit of at the end of the day to kind of finish and just see if there's any last things people want to know about. But yeah, as I said, at any time, just chip in or ask questions and so on. Yeah. Okay, so Padma Kamal is going to be the slide person.
Okay,
so it's page down.
Okay,
so why legacy fundraising? Why are we saying this is important? By the way, if anyone wants pen and paper, there's pads and pens over there if you need stuff. Yeah, I will be giving out a handout at the end of the day, which has kind of got all this in, but sometimes it's nice to have it in your own words, isn't it? So I'll give out this kind of toolbox at the end of the day. So why legacy fundraising? So if you go on a legacy fundraising day or go into that kind of world, what they tell you is that a lot of larger charities, or some larger charities, receive half their annual income from legacies. It's a huge proportion. And I found that hard to believe, but I was in a dentist's waiting room or somewhere like that at one time, and I happened to notice an annual report for the RSPB. And I looked in it, and it was true. Half of their income came from legacies. It was absolutely true. And there are some charities, the lifeboat one is the famous one, they get almost all their income from legacies. They're apparently the world experts in legacy fundraising, and that's where all their income comes from.
Who's that, sorry?
The RNLI, Royal National Lifeboat Institute. Yeah. So, partly I mention that because it's worth looking at their materials, as they are the world leaders. I mean, we're not going to be like that, because I don't think we'll ever get even 50% of our income from legacies. I doubt it, but so our strategy might be different, but nevertheless, interesting to kind of look at how they do things.
Can I mention I've got a calendar of the RNLI on the table outside? Mm. Very nice, glossy calendar. Just makes you want to die.
I mean, it sounds like this Peak District, to them, legacies was a key part of their funding. Very, very important. Yeah. So,
although it's interesting, if someone's got property, all it takes is one person, they leave a chunk of.
Yeah.
And the legacy we received was largely from through that, pretty much. And. We ended up getting kind of 50% of their total, so just it was doubled our income for that year. So it was 50%.
That's right.
So
even in a case like that, well, I imagine a lot of you could get a legacy one day. Well, I'm sure you will get a legacy one day, and it may well be it's the largest ever donation you ever get, or it's the largest ever amount of money you receive in one go. That's the kind of nature of it. And it could make a big difference. It just suddenly opens up all sorts of possibilities that weren't there before. Or even if you get a small gift, and this is going to be one of the themes throughout the day, that it's not just about large gifts, it's also about small gifts. Say you get a legacy of £5,000. It's just out of the blue, you didn't budget for it, so suddenly you can buy new furniture. Or you can buy a Rupert, a wonderful Rupert. You know, you can do something quite significant that you just could never have budgeted for before. Do you know what I mean? So don't just think in terms of big legacies. There's a whole range that's possible, but even a small legacy can suddenly make a big difference to what is possible for your project to do. Yeah. So that's the first reason why this is important, because it can make a big difference. Second thing is, apparently 60% of people in England and Wales make their will in their 60s. Yeah? And that time is the time of life when most people are likely to include a charity in their will. Mm. And of course, our movement is ageing. And apparently outside India, 40% of order members are in their 50s and 60s. So that's kind of interesting, isn't it? We don't have stats for people in the movement, mitras and so on. But basically, there's a lot of people who are kind of getting to the age in life where you start thinking about these things. Yeah. So, in a way, you could argue that now is the time to be doing legacy fundraising, to have that as part of our fundraising work and so on. Yeah. And last point, I know of at least 5 True Ratner centres in the UK that have received large legacies in the last 10 years. So that is at least every 2 years. One of our centres in the UK is having that experience of a major difference being made to them through a legacy. And, you know, I think if we do more legacy fundraising work, and bearing in mind this, that will increase as time goes on. Yeah. So just to tell you a few of the little stories, because they're sometimes very inspiring stories. There's the story of Bristol Buddhist Centre, who'd moved into a big new centre, big growth, but they were struggling. It was a kind of struggle to kind of make that transition and to pay the mortgage. Mm. And they were even facing the prospect of having to kind of downsize again, which is such a kind of dispiriting thing, isn't it? And then an order member who'd been in Bristol for years, lived in the community for years, Sinachitta, he died. Mm. He was in his 70s, lovely old man. And it's a very moving story, actually, that the morning he died, they found a cheque on the mantelpiece for £5,000 that he'd made out to the Buddhist Centre. And I have no idea why he did it, but it allowed them to carry on paying the mortgage for, you know, a good few more months. And then they discovered that in his will, he'd left them a whole load of money, enough to pay off the whole mortgage. Yeah, so they basically paid off their mortgage. The Buddhist Centre, it now belongs to them. it's extraordinary, isn't it? It's like he gave them the money just while all the kind of legal stuff was being sorted out, and then he paid off the mortgage for them. Yeah, very amazing story. The Abhaya Ratna Trust is another example. So that was a whole new charity that got started through someone leaving a legacy. You know, that charity wouldn't exist. We wouldn't have that project if it wasn't for that single legacy. Or there's the, you know, Pablo Camara's mentioned the Birmingham story. They got a big legacy, and that's eventually there's going to be a big building project here, which has been made possible through that.
Joy, just to mention that we've received two large legacies of Abhaya Ratna, right. £20,000 as well.
Right. Yeah.
So that paid for all the work in
yeah.
the country.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
Got,
yeah. Mm. Yep.
So, got I'm aware of uh-huh. our ancient history. Aritara, which is, goes back to the very early days, long before any of us in this room, is now owned by the Croydon Centre because Sarah Boyne, who was one of the original 12 altar members with her then husband Emil Boyne, died 18 months ago and then left Aritara, which they've always had to pay rent on, to Sarah's father, who died the year before, and he was in his 90s. He left it to Sarah. She's left it to the Croydon Centre. But her husband, a second husband, has to enjoy the rents from the rents of Aritara till he dies. But that's the current situation. It's property worth 600,000 at least. Mm. It's in Perlage. Mm. It's huge value.
Yeah.
It's worth far more than the centre building.
Right. That's a really interesting example. We'll come back to that later. Yeah. Here. Right.
You mentioned the LBC situation.
Yeah.
So the LBC spent a lot of money over the last few years on its own building project. Spent about £2 million. So a lot of money. And at the end of that project, we are sort of struggling a little bit with our cash. Mm. We found ourselves struggling, probably unsurprisingly. Mm. Mahananda died. Let's say last April, and he left a property which is worth about £2 million, or £1.2 million, so it's a huge gift, but we're not in a position to sell it at the moment. But basically the rent income is, I don't know where we'd be without the rent income. I mean, there are costs associated with it as well.
Yeah.
But somehow it's the timing of it's really interesting,
yeah.
and it really
yeah.
is helping the LBC.
Yeah. So you kind of get the picture, it can make a huge difference. I suppose the reason I'm emphasising this is I just wondered whether some people might be a bit sceptical about it. You might go to your trustees and say you want to run a legacy fundraising campaign, and you know, there might be a bit of scepticism or a bit of kind of uncertainty about it, but it's well worth it. But it is a particular kind of fundraising, so it isn't predictable. You know, things happen by surprise. So that's why people might think, well, it's not really worth investing in this because we don't know what's going to happen. But it is. It, you know, if you do this, you will get some legacies and they will make a big difference. Yeah. On the fundraising day I went on, I think they said for every pound you invest, you get £39 back or something like that. I mean, how do they work that out? But, you know, the idea is that it's very well worth investing in. Yeah. But yeah, it's a particular kind of fundraising. It's not predictable. It's going to happen. You know, you do the work now, but you might not get the fruits until many years in the future. Mm. Yeah, that's the nature of it. Mm. But it's still really worth doing because one day it will make a huge difference.
So can I just mention one
other
thing?
Yeah.
So there's the financial benefits of doing it, but I think there's real Dharma benefits.
Yes.
There's a lot of potential for talking about death and, you know, Dharma practice. And,
yeah.
You know, so there's a lot to be said about that.
Yeah.
Isn't there?
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, in a way, yeah, when we were thinking about this, we thought, it's really surprising we haven't done this. Mm. Given that we're Buddhist and we're supposed to be aware of impermanence and blah, blah, blah. Why haven't we kind of done this very much? So, yeah, I think there is real potential to kind of do it, and for us as Buddhists to have a kind of quite a unique, interesting approach to all this, actually. I'd be really interested in exploring that more. Yeah. Yeah. Apparently also legacy fundraising is a major growth area in fundraising at the moment. Apparently, especially in a recession, other kinds of fundraising can, not necessarily, but can become harder. And a lot of charities kind of particularly emphasise this because, you know, you only pay later. There are various terrible legacy fundraising jokes which I'm trying not to make because I think they're so abysmal.
Like the dead giveaway.
Yeah.
That came up in my training day.
Yeah, the guy who runs it, oh God, terrible jokes. Die now, pay later, that kind of thing. Oh.
Environmental charities, which is pushing up daisies. I want to be pushing up daisies.
Right. Yes. There's a fantastic Greenpeace one about something to do with being reborn as a whale. I can't quite remember.
I'm really glad you came back as a whale.
So we could come up with something like that, couldn't we? Maybe there's a kind of Buddhist, a little Buddhist angle. Okay, next slide, Papakapura. So I'm just going to start off with a few general fundraising principles. Some of you will be familiar with this, but it's just to kind of warm us up a bit and kind of get going. But also asking the question, these are general principles about fundraising, is legacy fundraising a bit different in some ways? So the kind of next slide is principles of legacy fundraising. Mm-hmm. And just before this, just to quickly mention, some of you will know this, there's all the resources on the Centre Support website. So if anyone's not come across those yet, Samaya Shree and Siddhi Sambhava have put lots of very, very good resources, general fundraising know-how on the Centre Support website. There's a whole fundraising section of that site. Probably one of the best sections of the site. Okay, so people give because they're inspired by a vision. Yeah. This is going to be a bit of a theme throughout the day. So in any kind of fundraising, and including legacy fundraising, it needs to be the vision, which is kind of at the forefront. You've got to kind of inspire people and make them feel that by giving to you, they're going to be helping fulfill that vision, which they share with you. Yeah? So Samaya Shree sometimes defines fundraising, it's a conversation about unfulfilled ambition. An interesting definition, conversation about unfulfilled ambition. So yeah, you and they have the same vision, you discover through communicating, and they just want to help you fulfill that vision. That's what it's about. That's what you've got to kind of communicate. Yeah? The mechanism by which they do that is secondary to that. Yeah. So whether it's a standing order or a legacy, yeah, at some point you're going to ask in a particular way, you're going to make a particular ask, but that's kind of the next thing down the list, as it were. Yeah. So all this is what's called the case for support. And Siddhi Sambhava used to bang on and on about the case for support. But she was right. You get the case for support right, it will work. Yeah. People want to support success, not prop up failure. Yeah. That is apparently a key thing. So you've got to communicate that you're successful. This is probably especially true in legacy fundraising because it's a long-term gift. It's not going to happen for some years, maybe. And so they are going to want to be confident that this project you've got, it's not just a kind of temporary thing or it's not going to fizzle out. Mm-hmm. Do you see what I mean? So I think there's probably something about that you've particularly got to communicate in legacy fundraising, that you are a serious, long-term, sustainable affair. As it were. Yeah. People give to human stories, local, particular human stories told by someone credible. Yeah. So yeah, just making it as human and as local and as particular as possible. Not kind of abstract stuff, but you know, real examples of real people whose lives are going to be transformed by what you do. Yeah. They want to be sure the charity will use their money well, so in a way that kind of overlaps with that one a little bit. People just want to know. I think, again, especially with a legacy, because it's a long-term thing, and it might be a large amount of money, they're really going to want to, they're really going to need to trust that you're going to, that you are efficient and responsible, and you're going to make good use of it. Yeah. So that kind of trusting, I think, is especially important in legacy fundraising. You need everyone in your organisation on board. Yeah. So basically, it's about consistency of message. That if someone comes in and they've heard about a fundraising campaign and they ask someone on reception, the person either knows about it and can give them the information, or can get them talking to the right person easily and quickly, as it were. Samaya Sri used to say that confusion is just a killer. You know, it's one of the biggest barriers to fundraising. Once people are confused, you've lost it. So it's got to be really clear and consistent. Everyone singing from the same song sheet.
Is it worth talking about the danger or lack of danger of competition between us?
Going to come to that later. Yeah, we'll come to that later. Yeah. And I think that is important. Yeah, maybe again, especially with legacy fundraising.
Because we're both one organisation
yeah.
and a multiplicity yeah. of organisations.
Yeah. So there, I think there are areas that we might need to be careful of. So we might know someone who's got a lot of money, and they suddenly start getting all these requests from there could be a kind of awkward situation, we're going to come to that later. I think it's worth us thinking about that and talking about that a bit. And another key principle, people often don't give at the first request. I think Samaya Sri quoted something like, you might send 14 letters before you get a standing order. Yeah. But the important thing about this is people don't mind. They don't mind being asked again and again, as long as it's done in the right way. Yeah, so there's a way of kind of asking and reminding people, which doesn't feel like being harangued. It feels like they're just getting more inspiring information about what this charity is doing. Do you know what I mean? If you do it the right way, you can just keep telling a story, keep reminding people, and it's inspiring, and they feel they're being communicated with about something they care about. And again, I think this is especially true of legacies, yeah, because it's a big thing. People will want to think about it. They will want to take their time about it. And, well, also human nature, it's one of those things that you keep putting off and off and off. So people will need a lot of reminding. That is the nature of legacy fundraising, as you'll see. It's just about gently keeping it keep reminding people periodically, every parent of our day. Or whatever it is, you know, just keep reminding people in the kind of interesting, inspiring kind of way. Yeah. Anything else on that?
Can I just stress the importance of all this? I'm in the middle of writing Manchester's case for support, and it's taking much longer than I would have liked it to, and that's partly because I'm actually working in the public sector. I think it's really important, because I think it can start to help sort out some of the confusion, and that's certainly true in Manchester.
Yeah.
I think the sort of the landscape I'm working in is a bit confused. The centre hasn't been that sure of its vision, I think, over the past few years. And I think writing the case for support just really starts to ask the important questions.
Yeah.
Of the trustees, of the chair, of the other workers. And I think this thing of getting everybody on board as well, again, it's not a straightforward task, and it's certainly been my experience. You know, it's an ongoing experience. But again, it's so important.
Yeah. So Sudhi Sambhavi used to bang on and on about that. Well, in fact, she used to, you know, a lot of people used to contact her asking for advice. And often her advice would be, don't start fundraising yet, because you don't actually know what your vision is. And if you start fundraising prematurely, it's just a mess.
You just get confused.
Yeah. So that's a really important point.
Samaya Sri, I think when you talk, you know, you might spend 18 months going through this kind of process before you're ready to actually fundraise, say, for a year.
Yeah.
Which I thought was quite interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So that case for support is a big thing.
Yeah.
That's right at the start. Yeah.
And it's really important work.
Yeah.
I think that's
Yeah.
That's what I have to keep reminding myself, is that in terms of helping to develop Manchester's vision, this is just such important.
And I'm glad you brought that in, because in a way I kind of assumed you've got that, and we're now talking about legacies fundraising as a particular avenue or application of that, but I think it's really important we make explicit that does need to be there at the start, and then you can start applying it in different areas.
I think the interesting thing is that it's a long-term vision, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because you're asking people to think maybe 20, 30 years in the future.
Yeah.
So it's not just a vision for the next 5 years.
Yeah.
Which is quite an interesting
vision. Yeah, that's right. Yep.
So just coming back, because, well, certainly in Cambridge it's been very difficult, because actually the council have just not wanted to go near the case for support.
Yeah.
It's like, well, how do you do that when the council just are not?
Yeah.
It's like, well, it's just not that important at the
moment. Right,
It's been quite a long term problem.
Yeah, sure. Maybe you need to get someone in to talk to them. Tell them, you know, just try and someone else saying how important this is and how all these other things won't work unless that's in place.
And I think also we've got to do it well. In a sense, we've got quite, we're in a very unique situation actually. We don't own the building.
It's owned by
Windhorst Trust.
Yeah.
The chair is actually paid by Windhorst Trust.
Yeah.
So it's a bit more, we've got a
complicated
situation actually.
Yeah. Yep.
That was what was interesting about what Samaya Sri was saying, is that, you know, very often it's what takes the time is it's the human beings. You know, we might all agree principally, as it were, but when you get people together you start to get disagreements, and but the problem is if you're up there trying to fundraise and there are those background disagreements, it just shows quite clearly. And so if people don't want to look at the possible difficulties, then it's just going to not lead to an effective fundraising.
Right.
The other thing about case support is that it actually benefits your organisation generally, I think. It's not just a financial thing.
Because I think it brings people together.
Exactly.
Because they're going to work on a sort of a joint vision.
So can you see how this applies? It's interesting how you've got to apply all this to legacy fundraising. So you need your case for support. But then there's Satya Joshi's point that it's got to be long term. So you've got to communicate to people something about where you're going long term and your vision long term. And then there's the perception that I think is at a lot of centres, that people see this lovely centre and they think, oh well, they're all right, it's all done. Manchester, I think, it's like that. And so you've got to. It's about showing people that actually you're not necessarily all right. You do need support and help, but what that's going to mean long term. Yeah, so it's a particular kind of way you've got to communicate all that case for support with legacy fundraising. Yeah.
And that's why looking at other organisations is very illuminating, because you can just see they've been through a whole process and come up with a great little slogan, pushing up daisies or whatever. Mm-hmm. But behind the slogan is a lot of thought, really.
Yeah.
It's kind of come to that point.
Yeah.
It struck me listening to, when I looked at your calendar you showed me earlier on, the one and Stupid Lifeboats, there is, knowing a little bit about them and being very aware of them, having lived on the coast up in Scotland, that there's something particular about what underlies them, and it's about saving lives.
Yeah.
And the Peak District is about life and legacy, but it's life enjoyed. Out of the Peak District.
Yeah.
So there's a crossover there, and whether we can get Dharma legacy fundraising, something that's associated with life, it strikes me there's a very interesting theme there that's quite different in both of them, but there is a commonality in it.
Yeah. It's interesting because I've been writing this brochure for the autumn, and I've been using Banti's poem Life is King. Not quite sure if it quite works, but it's interesting. That was where I went. That was my kind of first idea.
That's what struck me listening to both those places. I thought about them.
Can we have the next slide? So here's some more principles of fundraising, but particularly applying to legacies fundraising. So first one, yeah, just be, although I'm going to use the word legacy ad infinitum today, apparently in brochures and things it's not a good word to use. It sounds a bit legalistic, and also it sounds like it means a huge gift, whereas it might not be that that people are thinking of leaving you. So often if you look at wills, brochures and that kind of material, it says something like, please leave us a gift in your will, rather than leave us a legacy or a bequest. Mm. Yeah. So we're going to do more on kind of language later, but that's a kind of important thing. And then another general principle of fundraising, which, you know, someone like Samaya Shree would stress very strongly, is that people give to specifics. Yeah. What inspires someone is, you know, we're going to buy this rupa, or we're going to support these people, or we're going to build this new building. Something kind of specific and tangible. Yeah. But this links to what Sacerdoti was saying. In the case of legacy fundraising, that's a bit more tricky, because you can't be that specific about something that you might not get for 20 years. Mm. So that's quite a challenge. Mm. You've got to think, how can we make this tangible and real and honest, you know, and yet we're not going to be kind of tying ourselves down to something that we might not want to do in 20 years' time. Do you see what I mean? So that's a particular challenge of legacy fundraising. Yeah. Many people, maybe most people, will have partners and families that they want to remember first and foremost in their will. So again, you just need to be aware of that and be sensitive around that, and word your brochure or whatever it is in a way that recognises that. And when you're in your communication with people, just recognise that there may be other people that are going to come first and foremost, but nevertheless, they still might want to leave you something, leave you some kind of gift. Yeah? And again, when we do wording later, we'll just look at different ways you could word that. Yeah.
I think what Ratna Tudor said is quite interesting, that Sarah Boyne made a will which was quite specific. She provided for her husband while he was alive, but then her will kind of carried on.
Yeah.
And it came to the Buddhist Centre in full later.
Yeah.
It will do.
So you can kind of remember partners and family and still give it to the Buddhist Centre, not till another person died.
Yeah. We did a couple of focus groups here with Mitras and Order members, and kind of asked them about these areas, and a lot of people with families said, you know, obviously their family would be in their will first, but they would want to give something to the Buddhist Centre. So, you know, it's just worth being aware of that. We'll come to this later, but there's different kinds of legacy that you might get. You might get a big one, or you might get something small from people who've got families. Yeah. So let people go at their own pace. Just gentle reminders, recognising human nature and how we put these things off, making a will. And you can make it joyful and life-affirming, which is Ratna Tudor's point. Yeah. It's about people making a difference after they've died, which people find very inspiring. That is something that people do think about and they find very inspiring. So you can just you can take that for kind of granted, as it were, but actually it's not kind of a gloomy thing which people aren't going to want to talk about. It can be joyful, it can be inspiring, it can be life-affirming. Yeah. And Manjusri's point, it might be that we could develop quite an interesting dharmic perspective on this. Just getting people, thinking about impermanence and letting go and interconnectedness and so on. Yeah. What happens to us and what happens to what we own when we die, as it were. And maybe being a little bit careful that that doesn't get too contrived and it feels a bit, you know, like that. But, well, actually, I think there's real potential in there for us. I think it could be really quite inspiring and interesting. Yeah. And apparently on the day I went on, they said older people don't mind this either. They don't mind you talking to them about legacies and about death and so on. If it's done, you know, kind of sensitively, inspiringly, and even with a bit of humour, it's completely fine to talk about these kind of things with people. Yeah. And then last key principle, it's all about drip, 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 rather than one big splash. I think that's true of all fundraising, and it's probably especially true of legacy fundraising. Because it's a big thing for people that they're going to want to think about, because they'll keep putting it off, it's about that just process of kind of keep on reminding people. So it's you know, that was the trouble with this brochure before. It was one big splash. There was a brochure, it was great, but we didn't follow through on it, and therefore it may not have had as much effect as it could have done. And again, what I'll be arguing as we go through the day is I think legacy fundraising, it's about integrating that into the rest of your fundraising campaign. So it's a kind of aspect of your overall fundraising work. Yeah. So you might have some specific legacy fundraising materials. You might have a brochure for people that are interested in remembering you in their will. But also in all your other things, you just keep mentioning, oh, by the way, blah, blah, blah. Do you see what I mean? It's integrated. So when Birmingham launched their capital fundraising thing, well, they're asking for immediate donations, but in the mix might be just some kind of gentle reminders. Yeah. And we'll explore, yeah, a bit later more how that works. Yeah. Anything else on that?
What about asking people to reconsider periodically? Because, you know, you're not going to leave the Buddhist Centre in your will until you've become a Buddhist.
Uh-huh.
And you might have made a will already, and then what we'd be asking, really, is for people to reconsider.
Yeah.
As their values change, you'd want their will to change.
Yeah. Yep.
But that's quite a particular request.
Yeah.
And if you got it wrong, it could be seen as quite manipulative. You know, forget your kids.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Leave it to the Buddhist Centre.
Yeah. Don't leave it to London. Birmingham.
But if they didn't remake it, it would go to their old sense of priorities. Yeah. Whatever that was.
Yeah. So yeah, I think in your materials, you're asking people to leave a gift in the will, and that might mean they change their will.
Mm.
And apparently, people do change their wills. They do it quite frequently, even in the last few years of their life. They will change, and they might include a new charity, or they might cut out a charity. Yeah. So that, again, we'll come to this, but I think that shows the importance of just staying in communication with people. Keep telling them your story, so that they don't change their minds and think, well, I haven't heard from them for a long time, maybe they don't need my money anymore, kind of thing. So stay in touch with people, just keep a flow of communication. And also, you can give, you know, when you're giving people technical information about how to make a will, you can give them the information about how to make a codicil, which is a kind of an amendment to a will. So that relates to what Lokaband is talking about. So on our website and in our brochure, that will have that information, and people can just copy that or use that themselves. Yeah.
Is it getting a bit easier to make a will as well? Isn't it?
Yeah. Okay, next slide. Okay, so this is a profile of a typical legator, however you pronounce that. That's somebody who's left a legacy, technical term. I got this from the fundraising day I went on. So this is what the research shows, apparently. So 2/3 of charitable... So, yeah, have a quick look at this, but then we're going to ask, does this apply to our context? Yeah, and I think in some ways it applies, and in some ways I think our context might be a bit different. Yeah. When we look at this, we're thinking, does this apply to us? And what are the implications for this about how you go about legacy fundraising? Yeah. So 2/3 of charitable legators are women. Dies in her early 80s and has amended her will within a few years of her death. which relates a bit to Loga Bode's point.
My granny used to remake it every week. Which grandchild was in favour?
Yeah.
It was just a hobby,
yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah. So there you go, so stay in touch.
I'll keep you all in order.
Stay in touch and keep your fingers crossed. Yeah. And of course...
And visit your granny.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't forget to send her a birthday card. And it's probably mostly women, partly because women are more spiritually advanced and more generous and all that, but partly because women live longer. Yeah, so that's the reason. So in Tree Ratna it might be a bit different because you've probably got a higher proportion of people who aren't married or don't have partners, and so it's the guys who actually kind of can leave the money. So, for example, those five examples I talked about earlier in the last 10 years, they were all men.
Mm.
Yeah, it happened to be that they were all men who were single, and when they made their will, they just left their money to Tree Ratna projects. Yeah. So, that kind of might apply to us in a particular way.
Well, this definitely applies to men, I feel very... Yeah, this is definitely summing me up.
Right. Actually, yeah. Huh. So. Interesting.
Huh. I also haven't done the bottom one, I'm
likely to have told the charities about that. Right, yeah. Hmm. So yeah, second one, the estate is worth 175k, the house being the prime asset. So that's interesting, so it's not necessarily people with masses and masses of wealth. Again, I think that's an important point. It's not necessarily people with, you know, massive houses in London, for example. It's a kind of whole range of people. Yep. Often cash poor but asset rich. Mm. And may have only made small donations to charities in their lifetime. So there's a very interesting story from Karanar. They had a woman who made a standing order donation to them for many years of £2 a month. Yeah, so little donation every month. You know, one of their smaller donors. But when she died, she left them £45,000. Mm. Yeah. So, you know, if you give the right message out, even to people who just don't seem like they're big supporters, as it were, well, it may be that that's all they can do at the moment, but in the future they will do more. So it's really worth kind of knowing that's how it works. Yeah. So stay in communication with all your supporters about this. You might want to take different tacks with different kinds of people, but don't, do you see what I mean? Consider the whole range. If she's a committed and regular donor to a charity, she's 7 times more likely to remember that charity in her will. So I think that's a major advantage for us because we have got committed sanghas. We've got, you know, we've got people who have very strong connections with us. So I think in a way that is one of our main strengths. And she names 3 quite different charities in her will. Yeah. So people might leave it to one charity, but often they want to spread it around, and they want to support different things. Yeah. So yeah, just kind of recognise that that's, you know, be sensitive to the fact that that's likely what people want to do. And yeah, unlikely to have told the charity. Yeah. We'll come to this later, but you can try and encourage people to tell you, so you know, but. Sometimes it will just be totally out of the blue, be a complete surprise.
We obviously received, I think it was about £28,000, which really just fits this.
Right,
actually.
Right.
But someone who was involved in the centre, I didn't know her.
Right.
But maybe a bit on the periphery or something.
Yeah.
And literally, we obviously received this cheque.
Yeah.
A copy of her will, and she'd left money to, at least 3 charities.
Yeah.
Quite different.
Yeah.
And just came out of the blue.
Yeah. So, okay. Yeah. That's interesting. So that links nicely to my next slide, actually. So I started, I tried to think this through. I thought, well, that's the kind of typical situation in the world. What will it be like within our community? And I tried to think of what are the kinds of people that might leave us a legacy? What are their kind of situations? And what would therefore need to be the approach for those different kind of people? I came up with 3 sort of categories of people. Yeah. So firstly, I thought there are people who've been part of our community for a long time. So maybe an order member or a mitra. And they don't have a family, you know, they've maybe lived in communities or they live on their own. But they've got some assets and they might, you know, leave those to Sri Ratna charity. That was one category of person. Second one is, you know, there'll be a lot of people who come to our centres, order members and mitras, who do have family responsibilities. So those people are going to be first in their will, but nevertheless they might want to kind of give something to their local centre or to a retreat centre that's been a kind of special place for them or a cause that they just really believe in. And so you might want to take a slightly different kind of tack with them. Do you see what I mean? And then the third category I thought of was what I called the surprise legacy. So it's just really interesting that we've had two examples of that already today. Mm. There's this woman who left some money to the LBC who wasn't particularly involved, but obviously thought it was really important and so left some money. And then there's this example of Sarah Boyne, who was involved years ago, hasn't been involved for years, but nevertheless obviously still has a connection. And suddenly you discover she's left you a house worth over half £1 million.
It's hard to know because Bhante keeps up connections with
right.
some people from way, way
back. Right. Yeah.
There's that woman running a Zen group, if you're still alive,
yeah.
It was the black case room once, or at the old centre, Salisbury Road.
Yeah.
And Paramartha knew that Bhante was in contact with us. You never know, there's a network that's really beyond our ken, as it were.
That's right.
So who knows, Sarah Boyne might have picked up contact with Bhante.
Yeah. So you might just get a surprise out of the blue. I've got another example that happened to me, was I was sitting in my office one day a year ago or something, and I got a phone call, and it was a guy who'd been involved in the movement years ago, and he's, you know, he's gone off and done something else now, but the movement was really important to him at a certain time in his life, and he said, I want to leave some money, who do I leave it to? So I said, oh, you leave it to the European Church Assembly. and, you know, I wasn't as crude as that. I said, well, what kind of things do you want to support? And he just said, well, I want to help a book be published or something like, you know, it was a kind of range of things he was interested in. So I said, well, if you leave it to us, every year we allocate money to different movement-wide projects. And it did fit the bill for him. So hopefully he's done that. But it was totally out of the blue. You know, he was involved years ago. Or it might be, I thought you could get somebody dies who's in our movement and their parents feel very grateful for what the movement did for them and say, actually, when we die, now this person's not going to receive our legacy. We'd like to give some of it to the Buddhist Centre, for example. So I think there could be things like that. So that just shows how it's worth communicating this in all sorts of different ways, in all sorts of different places. You know, so if you've got a newsletter, occasionally have something about legacies, because who knows what it might spark off, and suddenly you find you own a large building in Purley, which you didn't before.
I've just remembered that Manchester did receive a legacy last year, actually. £5,000, £4,500, £5,000.
Yeah.
And somebody, nobody knew.
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. We just got a letter from the executives of the will. I think it's 2 years since this old bloke. She said £5,000, and I asked Moksha Priya and Selma. You know, people have just been involved for years, and they just didn't know him at all.
So yeah.
The story was that.
Yeah.
It just occurred to me as well is that we've been contacted at least twice recently by people who've had some connection with the centre or sangha, not especially strong now, and they're dying, and they want a Buddhist funeral, and so it's obviously a very related area, and it's probably going to happen more as people get so. And that's obviously a context in which people might be receptive to leaving.
Obviously you'd have to handle that very sensitively, wouldn't you? But you might be able to say, look, there's certain things you need to do to prepare for dying, and one is making a will, and if you want any help about that.
I do remember Samaya Shri talking about some, if it came up at some point, if on one of these days, if there was someone who was donating to a campaign that she was running and they died, so they died quite early and someone else was looking after her, and they, because they would usually keep in touch, they got to find out, she would contact the people who informed her and said, well, you know, how's this person, would you consider, this was a charity, a cause that they were interested in supporting, and just sensitively encouraging them to think about that when they, you know, distribute this person's kind of effects or something that hadn't been thought of already. So she was quite kind of this person did want to support you alive, why not? They want to do that when they die.
I find faced with a particular problem when somebody I'm taking on his journey through melanoma, and he's in his 50s, and he was learned to meditate the LVC years ago, and he lives over in Surrey, and he does come and see me for therapy, but both myself and Don of Korea as executors, so it's very much a very personal journey. And I was just listening to that, whether I can go beyond, because he has written, done his will, his parents are still alive, he's the main carer for his parents, so it's a whole sad case. Where else, because he's very fond of what you receive from the LVC, and where I can go a step further with him, I don't know at the moment. I'm not clear in my own mind, but knowing that both Donna Prey and myself will conduct his funeral, and I think I'm a sort of executor, although he's got different terminology with his lawyer.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Where else I can go beyond it. I've got, I think I'll internally I'll have to look at myself where I'm in relation to that.
So it's interesting that I think this kind of fundraising does can take one into these kind of areas where you need a lot of sensitivity and awareness, and but there may be opportunities to suggest something which people will actually really welcome. So and I think in our context, in the Tree Ratna context, and an added dimension of that is there might be someone who's a Buddhist but their family isn't Buddhist, and their family may be very supportive or they may not be, and so you need to be aware of that and just take that into account.
The answer's just come to me. It's the long term in the house. To their own. Parents and their actors. I think I can. I'll just ask him what happens to it.
I suppose it's just that you've got material around mentioning give us a gift in the world. Because people then will pick that up. And they can make the decision, can't they? And that acts against that kind of perception you're talking about, like they come to a lovely centre like this and they think, oh, well, it's really rich, why would I give them any money? They don't need it. But if you've kind of got it around, that actually you do need something, that would allow people to make up their own mind that they do.
Apparently in the legacy, in the professional legacy fundraising world, they will try and get into one-to-one dialogue with people about this. So there will be, you know, they might run a big charity might run a campaign where a brochure goes out and there's a tear-off slip if you're interested in more information. And if they get that back, they may phone the person up, or, you know, so I think that is the way, that is the way it goes sometimes, is you are trying, if you can, to have a conversation with people. Okay. So just looking at those three a little bit more detail. So the long-term person who's got, hasn't got family responsibilities, it may be obvious to them who they're going to leave their money to. You know, they might live in Birmingham, they've lived in Birmingham for years, and they just have a real connection with the Birmingham Centre, for example. Or, you know, they might have gone to Padmaloka for many years and they just love it. But also there might be a movement-wide project you know, they're just really inspired by the work in India, and so they want to support India Dharma Trust. Yeah. And yeah, they may, even though they've been in Tremont and are living in a community, say, actually they might have assets from a previous career, or they may have inherited from their parents. Yeah. So someone who works within the movement and lives in the community, for example, they might not own property or they might not have a well-paid job, but actually they may still have some assets. So, and they may quite naturally just want to give that, you know, for some people, we are their family. Mm. Do you know what I mean? That is how they're going to quite naturally feel about it. We are their family, or their local Sangha is their family. So there is that kind of relationship which one can build on and enter into. Yeah.
But will we come back to that if they don't say in their will, they don't make a will,
right,
and even if they want that money to go to a Chiratana project, it right, might not end up doing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's really important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I don't know what the percentage is, but this is what we emphasised in last year, you'll see that so many people don't make a will, like you're saying. There's something about leaving a mess after you die or something.
Yeah.
We were just trying to encourage people to think about making a will. Maybe think about giving to the LDC, but the main thing is just think about
So
somewhere like this, there's a fair chance there might, you might be the major beneficiary, because they won't be looking after family first and giving you £5,000
mm-hmm.
as a goodwill gesture.
Mm-hmm.
They'll be looking around for someone to give the whole lot to.
Yeah.
Which could be us.
Yeah. Or two or three charities.
Or two or three.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, what I'm suggesting is, yeah, they might have a little bit of money tucked away, or they might have, you know, in Bhairatna's case, a house, you know, quite substantial, valuable asset. And in a way, we're their family, so there is a kind of natural relationship. But it's still worth, you know, it's still worth talking to them, because actually they might decide, they're going to be making a decision about which projects they leave it to. Yeah. And obviously we don't want to get into a kind of competition about that.
But then how do you avoid competition?
Yeah.
Because, you know, Tara Loka, India Dharma Trust, LBC are all going to be producing brochures and touring the country. And mailing supporters. And so on.
Yeah.
So competition can be good-natured.
Yeah.
Or, you know, competitive.
Yeah.
Again, it's whether you can identify with each individual's vision.
There's something about abundance, I think, as well.
Yeah.
I think, don't know if something Smaya Shree said was, well, it's like we can have a poverty mentality sometimes.
Yeah.
We can think, oh, there's only a certain amount of money.
Yeah.
I think from a fundraising point of view, it's almost like you should have assumed there's an infinite amount of money.
Yeah.
And somehow there's abundance, actually.
Yeah.
I could say more about that. So like our esoteric down for the India Dharma Trust is Ratna Sambhava. And there's just, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, we can limit ourselves in how we ask because we think there's a limited amount.
Yeah.
As soon as you open up, you're in a place of abundance, and people give abundance in different ways.
Yeah, because it's success, isn't it? It's giving to success. Yeah, maybe the thing about competition is more, if you discover someone has given a legacy to another charity, just kind of being okay about that and recognising that, you know, just, yeah, it's their choice and they've got reasons for making their choice. But yeah, it's definitely have that attitude of abundance and make the ask and tell them about you and what you're doing. Yeah. Okay. So someone, you know, involved with us but who does have family responsibility. So yeah, as I said, when we did the focus groups in Birmingham, people said, well, obviously our family comes first, but, you know, I would like to leave you £5,000, or I would like to leave you such and such, yeah? So, yeah, don't assume they won't necessarily leave you anything. This is an important point. They may not be aware that they can do that, yeah? So again, I think sometimes people think leaving a legacy, it's like leaving everything. Yeah, and they don't realise that actually you can have a will which says, you know, I leave 95% to my children, but 5% I'd like to give to this charity, or, you know, I'd like to give £5,000 to this charity and everything else is divided between my children. So people may not be aware that they can do that. So yeah, with this kind of person, you're trying, that's the, probably the message. You know, we recognise and respect that we ain't first on the list, but please think about doing something. Yeah.
This is where the Sarah Boyne type legacy comes in, where they may not be aware that they can provide for their partner during his or her lifetime and then give it to the birth centre.
Yeah.
It's more technically complicated.
Yeah, but it's possible.
Possible.
Yeah.
There's also, that something happened with my, I think my mum's will was originally like that, as in it was to, the house was going to my stepdad, and then it was coming to me. Mm. My stepdad's remarried, and that has affected the will. I don't think that technically that it doesn't automatically then come to me. So, but I think there is a way of doing it, but I'm not sure how that happens.
You'd be talking to solicitors, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
And explain what you want and assume they can.
But I think they did explain it initially, but then I think the remarriage does have an effect. I don't know whether that would affect your situation if you got remarried, but I think that it'd be worth us in a way looking into the technicalities of that. So it's sort of much clearer than they're doing.
Or advise people to get legal advice, in those kind of slightly more complicated cases. But if they get legal advice, they will find that there are definitely different ways that you can do things to kind of suit what you want. Yeah. So with the first category of person, you might be going you could be going for a range of legacies, small or large. With this one, it might be that you're going for a smaller one. So you need to communicate that a small gift or a you need to communicate how a small gift could make a big difference to you, or a large gift. So again, that's a kind of theme that's going to run through the days. When you're writing legacies material, don't just kind of unconsciously get into writing it as though you're looking for a big gift or a small gift. Do you see what I mean? Because you may put off certain people. Yeah. Just remember the kind of range of possibility. And then the next slide. The surprise legacy. So that was our third category. So, might be someone a bit on the periphery that we didn't know cared that much, but they did. They were really inspired. Or someone from the past, or even the parent or partner of an Om or Mitra. And they just feel gratitude. Yeah. So with this one, it may well be out of the blue, in a way there might be less you can do about it, but just have your message out there and include in that message occasionally something about legacies. Yeah. Just kind of be a bit aware of that as a possibility. Okay. So what I'd like to suggest now is we stop and have a tea break, and then we do an exercise which will take us up to lunch. So I suggest we get some tea and then go and then start doing the exercise fairly quickly rather than have a long tea break. And so I'll just say what the exercise is now, and then we can just break. Yeah. So what I'd like to suggest we do is we do a kind of SWOT analysis for our charity or our project. I'll explain what that is, but basically thinking through what we've got going for us and what might act against us in terms of if our project was going to run a legacies fundraising campaign. So SWOT, some of you will know this, it stands for strengths, weaknesses, opportunities and threats. Yeah, so you basically do a kind of quadrant. I meant to do a flip chart with this on, but you you have a piece of paper and you divide it into four quarters, and you've got strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats. Yeah. So the strengths are all that's in favour of your organisation in terms of whether you could get a legacy fundraising campaign on. So you've got two fundraisers in post, that's a strength. You've got a core committed Sangha who really like you, that's a strength. All the strengths that you've got. Then any weaknesses you've got. So, you know, your trustees aren't that convinced, that's a weakness. Opportunities. So there's a legacy campaign kicking off this autumn, that's maybe an opportunity, or we're just about to run a capital thing, maybe we could incorporate something into that, because it's really clear that we're, you know, still need money. And threats, you know, there's a recession coming, or whatever it is, you know. Strengths and weaknesses apparently tend to be kind of internal. So they're about your internal organisation. Opportunities and threats are external. So they're about what's going on in the world around you, which affects your organisation. That's how it's classically done, but don't worry too much about that. The main thing is strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats. So, yeah, just when you're doing that for your organisation, bear in mind the research on the typical person that leaves a legacy. So what's the implications of that for your organisation in terms of SWOT? Bear in mind what we've just talked about the Tree Ratner context and the kinds of people that we think might leave legacies in our community. And bear in mind those principles that we went through, the fact that people give to success, the fact that people give to specifics. Yeah, what does that imply in terms of your particular strengths and weaknesses and so on? Yeah. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if we have a bit of time doing that, well, we get some tea and stuff first, have a bit of a break, then have a bit of a time doing that, and then we'll just, at some point I'll come round and suggest you get together and share with another person or with another couple of people. Just have a little bit of time just to kind of share what you've discovered. Yeah. And in a way it's up to you how you do it. So it might be that if you're from the same charity you want to work together, or you start off doing it on your own and then compare notes. You know, you do what you want, that's completely fine. But we'll do that, and then that will take us up to lunch, and I could maybe get the lunch on if you want to do it. Whatever. Okie dokie. So we'll maybe have, I don't know, 3/4 of an hour for that. So we'll aim to have lunch about 1:15 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Good. Better press stop.